Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is novelist and screenwriter Kathy Aspden, and we're talking about her novel, The Mala Beads, a novel of hope and discovery in a time of chaos. Kathy, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I have to ask you, what precipitated you writing this novel?
Okay. So The Mala Beads. Well, actually, I feel like I used to be a spiritual person, and then I sort of lost that moment.
What kind of a person were you?
A spiritual person.
Okay.
I kind of had an idea that everything was happening for a reason. And then we were in a pandemic, and I couldn't find any.
And you know, a lot of people turn to religion and spirituality.
But I couldn't figure out how to get through it, despite all the things everyone was going through, and we were going through the same kind of things. Except,
were you living out in the Cape at that time?
Yes.
So I excuse me for digressing at this point.
No.
I've always wondered what was happening on the Cape during the pandemic, because it was bad enough to live in a major urban area like Worcester, but you are always so isolated, but it's not summer.
You know, we're not as isolated as you might think we are, and we definitely had a front row seat because we were dealing with everything that everyone else had, and we had, I would say it's a small community hospital, but it really isn't. It's become a pretty large hospital over the years. But definitely having a smaller environment made you see things firsthand because and in my case, definitely firsthand because my husband, who was in his 70s, decided to go back to work as a respiratory therapist full time.
Wow.
Yeah.
He was needed.
He was needed, and a lot of people were bailing at that point, taking their retirement because they were closed or... it was hard. It was hard to make a decision about what was in.
How did you feel? How did you feel about that?
I was proud and terrified.
That sums it up perfectly. That's always a great juxtaposition to be feeling.
I feel like a lot of people might be proud and terrified.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I have a feeling that when it comes right down to it, you have no real control over what anyone does, nor should you.
Yep.
And so I was sort of watching it from a distance, but then completely unraveled by it, like tormenting my husband. He'd come in the door and everything would go into the UV machine.
Oh, yeah. And
you know, it was just a lot. And so, and I was, you know, ridiculous, beyond helpful, and spreading my anxiety full time, like it was my job. And then our daughter got sick, and she was 8 months pregnant with her second child, and she got COVID.
Oh my God.
So, and that was when, you know, it was in the beginning when we didn't know what it would do to a baby. We didn't know if they would let her take the baby home. We didn't know any of that. And so a friend of mine gave me some mala beads, which are just an ancient prayer necklace. It really is a counting method for counting your intentions and your prayers. And
how many beads are on the string?
It's 108 beads, which is a very sacred number. It's actually the number of life and humanity. I don't know if you know anything about sacred geometry, but there's a rhyme and reason to the numbers of things on Earth, and including the petals of a flower and DNA, and they're all systematic in their numbers. It's an amazing study, which I've only barely touched on. But it's very fascinating. And so she gave me these beads, and we started doing a mantra together, and it was a very simple one, really the sound of breathing. And I started doing a mantra that was, I am happy, I am healthy, and I am loved, which are three things that everyone aspires to. So anyway, it started making me feel not just better, calmer, more grounded, but more connected to humanity and more connected to the things that were important in a way that felt bigger than me. So it didn't have to be my anxiety and my fear. And it sort of dissolved that in a way.
Did you feel like this was very much akin to any kind of meditation or even yoga, where your body and mind sort of becomes very focused and relaxed?
Yes, definitely. Although I never would have, I feel like I'm so active, action-oriented, that I meditation was always hard for me because...
You had to calm down.
Sit there and do nothing.
That's the downfall of many people. That's the downfall of many people in meditation.
Yes, exactly. And I always had this idea that I was not, even, you know, even meditation, you're supposed to let a thought come, acknowledge the thought, and let it go. You know, and the trick is don't go down the rabbit hole with that thought. And I could never do, I do it now. I couldn't do it then. I was always down the rabbit hole. You know, one thought I'd be finally, the meditation would end with, what am I even doing here? I've got so much to do. So, yeah, I was a mess. And
well, you were Kathy, you weren't a mess. You were normal.
I was probably very normal, actually.
Yeah.
And what is normal, frankly?
I think it's that.
Yeah. Possibly.
So, okay, keep going.
It gives you something. It gives you something concrete to do. You
yep,
know, you
yep.
can, yeah. And so I started thinking about what that would be like for everyone to have, the miracle of putting out a manifestation of what you want, whether it's peace or calmness or a solution to a problem. And I just wrote one little story about, you know, as I called it, ask and receive, like to literally ask the universe for something that might be in your best interest. And the universe doesn't always say yes, and the answer isn't always what it's in your best interest, even if the answer is no, frankly. And so when I started writing that story, it grew, and the story of the mala beads just passing from hand to hand, with each person having their moment to manifest something that they needed. So that's basically how the story started.
So it's it's essentially a chain novel. That
it is. It's called the Connected Short Story Novel. So it's that the whole book creates the arc, the full arc of a novel. And each individual story is a full story that could be read independently. So a connected short story novel. Yeah.
Now, one of the interesting things about a novel that's structured this way is, did you storyboard the entire novel out so that you knew where you were at certain points, or did you just let it flow?
Oh, I wish I could tell you I was that organized. I am an intuitive writer, so I just let my characters tell me where they want to be next, and then I try to keep up. And sometimes keeping up means researching, you know, where do you want to live? And suddenly I'm researching that area. Or
okay, wait.
Yeah.
But Kathy, this is a long and complicated story, since every chapter, which is a separate story, is focused on an individual character. And
right.
It's not just taking place on the Cape, although the first couple of ones are. It goes all over the place.
Yeah.
Although it doesn't. No, this is the weird thing, and this is I wanted to ask you. It actually doesn't go all over the place. It goes to certain places, but
yeah.
Then doesn't go to other ones. You got to tell me how you figured this out.
Okay, so I didn't.
Never say that.
I almost feel somewhere between pathetic and apologetic and, look, aren't I a wizard?
You're never one thing. I get the feeling you're never one thing.
I don't think I am either. You know, that would be way
But it's such boring. A complicated story. That's what I'm saying. I'm really surprised you didn't storyboard it out.
The question that I get asked the most when I actually do not other interviews or book events or anything like that. I get asked that question more than anything else. How did you get from one person to the other, and how did you pass the beads, and how did you know where to go? And the thing is, initially when I started writing it, I wrote a huge list at the bottom of – so when I write, I write lists of to-do almost at the bottom of, mm-hmm. of the pages, and it just keeps rolling down with what I've written. And, you know, the list said, oh, I'll write a story about – a guy who's searching for a job, and I'll write a story about someone else who's lost in a whatever, and somebody else who's whatever. Well, 3/4 of those stories didn't even get in the book, because what would happen is I would finish a story and then somebody else's story would come in my mind. And I did not know how that person was even connected to the last person. So So it wasn't like I'd write the story of Charlotte and then say, now let's talk about Marianne. You know, there's none of that.
You'd have to wait till you got to the end, and then it would reveal itself.
Yes, and then the story would pop in. And so somewhere in the middle of the next person's story, I would find out how those beads were being transferred. Oh, that's why we're talking about her, because she is so-and-so's sister. And so a lot of it evolves when I sleep, to be honest with you. Like, I'll go to bed with the idea, and I wake up, and I'm like, oh, that's the answer. Or that's – and I've talked to a ton of writers who are more intuitive than they are constructing.
Okay.
And I mean, they say that it's the difference between being an architect or a gardener. You know, an architect really builds the story and then fills in all the spaces. And a gardener sort of throws it out there and hopes it's not a weed. But just whatever it grows into, if it is a weed, it's my weed, you know? So.
You're making me laugh too much.
A lot more of us, you know?
Well, I find that really interesting. How did she know when to end then? I mean, if the stories just keep, because the stories are wandering all in different places around the United States, although it's not random. Like, you'll end up like staying in a place for a couple of sections and then come back. Like, the first place off Cape, I think, or off in Massachusetts was, takes place in, I love this, Santa Claus, Indiana.
When I
yeah, you got to explain. You got to. Does every place have a story?
If you want. When I pictured a hometown hairdresser.
Okay.
And I was like, yeah, I'll put her in Indiana. And then I started thinking, gosh, you know nothing about Indiana. And I literally looked at Google Maps, and the word Santa Claus just popped out at me, and I was like,
oh my god,
Santa Claus, Indiana, like that. And then start, because I, when I'm doing all the research on it, it starts from scratch. Like, you do the first the map and the demographics. Are they near the water? Are they, you know,
whoa.
A lake nearby?
Okay. You do a map?
Yeah. So I literally open up maps and just go back and forth and like kind of look and see exactly where they are and what that means to that town and how they make their money and what.
Wow. This actually sounds fun.
It is fun. It's like a giant hole of research. You know, most of it isn't in the book, and most of it doesn't feel applicable, except it gives you the fabric of what a character looks like.
Yeah,
so that you can actually more fully understand what they might respond like in any
different
situation.
Sure, can you tell me anything about Santa Claus, Indiana? I've never been there either.
So Santa Claus, Indiana actually is a Santa Claus town. Like, they, you know, most of their... most of it is about tourism, you know, so picture.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Our Eagerville Railroad times 100.
That's exactly. Did they name their town so that they would become a tourist attraction, or did that come after?
I feel like the town was developed that way.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And it was, but it's a, you know, it's a small town. It's a very small town. And people, that's how they make their money, is attractions. And people stop on their way through to Santa Claus, Indiana.
I would stop there if I drove through Indiana.
Me too. I mean, think about it. We stop for that big ball of string. We stop for all kinds of little things. Santa Claus, Indiana sounds great.
Now, you're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is novelist and screenwriter Kathy Aspden, and we're talking about her new novel, The Mala Beads, a novel of hope and discovery in a time of chaos. Kathy, so you like, how do you get from Santa Claus, Indiana to the next place?
Okay, so
so is this revealed to you in your dreams or something?
Well, I don't know. See, I really almost don't know.
Did you write this book?
I know. I know, really and truly, I don't know all the details about it. And part of the reason is because so much of it is sort of, you know.
Intuitive?
I don't even want to use the word downloaded. Some of it is so downloaded as I'm writing that when I go back and do editing, I say, oh my gosh, yeah, that's what happened with them. I mean, it's almost a surprise. Like right now I'm editing the audiobook. And the woman that's doing it is amazing. And as I'm listening to her, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's right. That's how that ended up happening. And sometimes people tell me stories at book clubs, and And I say, I don't get the connection, you know, and until they tell it to me. And I say, oh, my gosh, it sounds like I planned it, but dear God, I wish I were that smart.
Well, and here's where we have to take everything down a notch, because a lot of the material in these stories is very tough and very, very grim. And it's amazing. Like, some of the stuff is just wild. Talk to me about dealing with that kind of material.
Well, so I have always said, I do a lot of interviewing for other authors, and if their books are really dark, I tell them I can't read the whole thing, but I can get the gist of it. And so when I'm going down to that kind of a story, nobody needs to be told in graphic detail what happened. They just need to know what the surrounding story is, because everyone has an imagination of what evil looks like. They have an imagination of what horror looks like. Yeah. And so even though I let myself go down those paths, I try not to make it in a way that you have to look away and stop engaging in the story. Because a story is always bigger than the evil that surrounds it. And a story is always more, there's more parts and pieces to the humanity aspect of something that you feel that's terrifying, or something that you feel that's evil. I mean, evil is the only way I can describe it.
Well, and some of the evil that's in the book is probably, to many people, they may not be familiar with. For instance, female genital mutilation, which is a horrible thing that happens. Is in your book, and did you obviously knew about this beforehand?
Well, so I knew about it, and a couple of years ago, I had watched a documentary about, they were interviewing a bunch of women, I think they were from Pakistan, Egypt, and places in Africa where it was common. And it just stuck with me. It stuck with me. Huh. And then when I started that story, and I researched how young the girls were.
Yeah.
And I have three daughters. I have nine grandchildren. Four of them are girls. I am not somebody who can almost stand that kind of thing. And so I had to humanize her story right away. In my mind, it had to be like, in my mind, she had to be strong enough that there could be light in her story. And I seriously wasn't sure how I was going to get from that point of her being a child and, you know, and having that happen to her, and then getting her to a point where there was light in her life. And weirdly enough, she got herself to that point. So I know that sounds crazy, but her story evolved in a way that I felt like she had put her protective barriers around her. She had made herself very, very capable. She found a lifestyle where she was feeling like she was helping people, and yet she had giant barriers around her that also stopped the love from coming in as much as they stopped the trauma from coming in. Her story is one of those stories that, had it not been for the love of another person, she wouldn't have been able to get to a full life. And that's a lot of people's story. A lot of people, you know, we're all weirdly individual islands, but then somebody touches us in a certain way, and we become somebody who maybe can get through some trauma for the sake of what it might mean to a fuller life with somebody that they really love. Her story, actually, I was doing the editing on that story last night, and that story can still make me cry. I can say
that was the story.
Weirdly enough, the stuttering story makes me cry the most of all the ones.
Which one?
You know the one where the woman is so distraught in her marriage because her husband doesn't speak?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that story, like, when you don't know what somebody's trauma has been, and then you somehow attach their entire story, you attach it to how it makes you feel.
Sure.
And you don't even know their whole story. And that story opened a floodgate of introspection for me. I mean, I don't have to explain how crazy I might be, but like,
yeah, I'll just accept it. Don't worry about it.
Just accept it. But I mean, I write on my walls in chalk because you can wipe it right off and nobody knows that you've been whatever.
Okay, you are crazy.
Okay, see, don't you think? But you should do it. White chalk on any paint comes right off. So on one section of my wall, it says, let people be themselves. And then I realized there was something wrong with that sentence. Like, and I had it for like 6 months, let people be themselves. And then I realized what I really meant to say was accept people for who they are.
Yep.
You don't have to let them be anything. And so I feel like that happens with my characters. Like, just accept them for who they are, go along for the journey, figure it out. If they're putting you in a place you've never been before, well, God knows you're lucky enough to live in the age of internet. So,
well, listening to you, and I've talked to other authors who are like this too, it really sounds like the characters become real to you outside of yourself.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I like to think that there's somebody in each one of these characters, an experience that actually is somebody's real experience. I just don't know them yet.
Huh.
You know,
have you been lecturing and then suddenly recognized somebody in the audience that is one of those people?
No, but I do have people that as I start to do a character, another person that I already know will be in the back of my mind. And I'll think, oh, my gosh, they're acting just like so-and-so, as if some part of my mind isn't making that happen. Okay, like, oh, they're acting just like him, or they're acting just like her. And then I realize that's sort of the person that's modeling, or it's always a composite character of, like, you know, of a bunch of different personalities or things I've known or things I've read. And sometimes I don't know what I know until I'm writing it down.
Now, one of the features of your book that I think really brings it up and beyond just a novel is at the back of the book, there is a list of charities at the end of the book for each chapter.
Yeah.
Talk to me about putting that together, because I found that really valuable.
Well, so I was done writing it, and I was ready for publishing, and then suddenly it occurred to me that not even could the book become more, but that these people in the book were more. And I started thinking about what each person's story was and what their charity would be. And so I began another, research journey and started looking at the charity that would be applicable to them in the area in which they lived in the book, so that the charities were, were very...
This is an enormous amount of research.
It was, and sometimes, like right at the very end, I was changing my mind about a few different charities because I'd find another one and think, oh, my gosh, that really is what their charity would be. I don't know. All right, so like Senora, who is the one who experienced female genital mutilation.
Right, right.
Her charity wouldn't be about female mutilation. It would be about giving back to the Yoga Foundation so that everyone would have access to yoga. Because that was what she views as having saved her, was a yoga teacher that came to Egypt and actually settled her spirit back into her body. But then her boyfriend Barry, his project would be the Orchid Project, which is a project that is based on eradicating and helping people that have experienced female genital mutilation. So the story, the person themselves actually guided who the charity would be. And then I put links to all the charities and just a little explanation at the back of the book with their, you know, the character's name and the page numbers.
Wow.
And I feel like, and I, you know, I haven't done a ton to connect to that because I didn't want it to seem gratuitous in the beginning. Like the book's been out for a few months and I know it's moving around the country. The other day, somebody sent a picture of it in the front window of a bookstore in La Jolla. And I was like, what? I mean, how did it get there? I didn't call them. And so different things like that. But at some point, I'm going to, in the most gracious way, start connecting these charities to this book because I want people to be able to benefit from it that way.
Well, they all have websites that you can visit.
Exactly.
And all of them, for the most part, that I could figure out are ones that I knew. are really worthwhile websites to help you deal with specific problems.
Yeah.
Environmental problems. I mean, all sorts of stuff is covered
in
that book.
But I've never let them know. I've never actually, like, sent anybody messages that said, hey, guess what? Hey, guess what?
Yeah, checks in the mail.
In the back of my novel.
Kathy, is this your first novel?
Oh, no, this is my third novel. So I have another series. It's called the Irishman series. And I was actually
The Irishman series?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
go for it.
I was writing the third novel to that series when I got grabbed by the Malabites. But the Irishman series is actually the first one is called Baklava, Biscotti, and an Irishman. And it's a bit of a love triangle.
Oh, so it's like romance novel?
No, it's a little epic. It's a love story, but it's a little more epic than that. It starts out in Niamakri, Greece at the tail end of the Vietnam War.
Oh, my God.
And it goes back toward, and actually, you know, flashbacks to, like, the Ottoman Empire. And that was actually a finalist for the Multicultural Fiction Award for International Book Awards.
Congratulations. That was great. This sounds fascinating. Are you going to go back to the writing like that? Has the Malabides, like,
well,
sort of...
believe it or not, the writing is the exact same. And I know that sounds crazy.
So you have a different person for every chapter?
It was back and forth from past to present, back and forth in this couple's storyline. And again, I didn't map it out at all. And so at the very end of it, when it was done, and I realized... I think not when I changed chapter that I realized.
We've completely run out of time.
Oh, goodness.
I know, and I still had all these other questions. And my guest tonight has been novelist and screenwriter Kathy Aspden, Aspden. And we're talking about her novel, The Malabides, a novel of hope and discovery in a time of chaos. Kathy, give out your website.
It's www.kathyaspden.com.
Thanks so much for being here, Kathy.
Oh, thank you, Mark. This was so much fun.
It was fun. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.